We love to say that what is measured improves. It is a fine idea that applies to many walks of life, including athletic performance. Starting with Inside Tracker and now rapidly expanding, an industry has emerged to help wise athletes and longevity seekers alike to measure, track changes over time, and even optimize lifestyle behaviors, which supplements to take, and pharmaceuticals to target low all-cause mortality levels for blood-based biomarkers. And since the human body relies on many organs and biological processes to survive and thrive, scientists have also developed biological age calculators that combine a set of actual versus optimal blood markers to assess overall health status relative to quote-unquote normal in order to calculate a biological age or rate of aging, and in longevity circles, a biological age lower than chronological age is a badge of honor. And it's a booming business. But just how accurate are these blood tests that all of this science and my own blood tests are based on? It's a question that has been haunting my thoughts over the last year, as I have aggressively measured my blood markers and calculated my biological age every 3 months in an effort to fine-tune my longevity interventions. So today on episode 141, I am joined by Dr. Austin Baraki, who argues that blood testing is an important but challenging area of medicine. He argues that people should not put too much faith in imprecise technology measuring indirect markers of biological function. False precision can lead to overconfidence and distract people from the lifestyle improvements that would really make a difference. He also shares his tips on reducing the variability and error in your own blood test results. Well, dang. The bloom is certainly off blood marker tracking for me, but listen in to decide for yourself. And be sure to check the show notes for the blood marker error bar tool that Dr. Baraki refers to during our discussion. All right, let's talk to Dr. Baraki about blood testing. Dr. Austin Baraki, welcome to the Wise Athletes Podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Joe. Nice to meet you and appreciate the invitation.
Oh, sure. Well, thank you. I got to say, you're kind of a rare bird. Medical doctor, strength coach, longtime athlete in multiple sports. I think you got a lot to share here. And I'm going to give you a second to tell us about yourself here in just a moment. But despite having a lot of things that I'd like to talk to you about, the one thing that I'm really interested in is the topic of doing blood tests, coming up with, you know, biomarkers from my blood. Well, that seems like a good idea, but what can go wrong? You know, all the way from the tests don't tell me what I think, or no one test can answer any question, or things that I did 2 days before or the morning of that ruined the results, or, you know, things like that. I would really love to get into it. Think we can do a good job on that?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I do wear a lot of hats. My main job, I work as a physician in practice, as an internal medicine physician. I do mostly inpatient medicine, some outpatient consultations, some telemedicine work. But I also, as you mentioned, have been a longtime athlete in a bunch of different sports. And then I work with a company called Barbell Medicine. I've been with them for over a decade now, where we put out a lot of educational content on various health, athletic, performance-related topics. Similarly, have a podcast where we talk about these kind of things. And in my main job as an internal medicine doc, meaning I don't perform surgery, but that means I do a lot of other things that don't involve using my hands, instead using my brain, and that includes performing, ordering, and interpreting a boatload of tests and imaging studies on a daily basis. That's kind of what I do a lot of the time. And so it is an area of interest for me, something I've talked about a lot before and happy to discuss today.
Well, fantastic. I want to point out that the audience is the Wise Athlete. So athlete, so there's a connection there. But they're older. You know, this is, the Wise is kind of a little bit of a play on words. It kind of alludes to older, but also, you know, people who are trying to become smarter, you know, about what's true, what works, how to get what you want, and the, you know, what I want and what people who listen to the podcast want is to be a strong athlete for a long time. And to do that, you got to be a healthy person and live a long time. So everything is game here, as long as it's sort of aimed at us, the older athlete. And so for blood tests, I've been getting blood tests, I guess, you know, anytime I'd get an annual physical, and my doctor would never really talk about it. As long as he'd be like, you're fine, bye. And, you know, and I didn't know anything about it. So I was happy to be fine. But for regular people, I think the medical industry is not really in favor of people getting lots of blood tests and looking at them regularly. And I'm not even sure why. So is that even true, what I'm saying?
Yeah, I can see how you can come to that perception. And so, you know, for context, yes, I have an athletic background. I work with a whole lot of athletes. But my main patient population that I see are, in fact, middle-aged and older adults. Overwhelmingly, nice. You know, internal medicine, especially inpatient medicine, is primarily kind of an older adult to geriatric type practice. So your audience are my kind of people, one way or another. If they're on the older side, that's most of the people that I take care of. If they're athletes, that's also a lot of the people that I interact with. What makes them a little bit less common is the fact that they are both at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. So most of the time when I'm admitting an older adult to the hospital, they are typically not, you know, a prime athlete. And that is due to the fact that being an older athlete goes a long way to keeping you out of the hospital. So I never actually meet you in that context. And similarly, it keeps you out of the clinic for a lot of sorts of, like, you know, complaints or concerns or things that come up because you're so much healthier than, quote unquote, you know, I wouldn't say the average necessarily, but like most of the people who use the most medical resources are those who have, you know, either severe acute conditions that need to be dealt with or long-term ongoing chronic diseases, most of which these days are things like heart disease and diabetes and certain types of cancers and chronic lung disease from smoking and things like that, that, you know, being an athlete who is very concerned about your health and performance tends to help kind of select you out of. And so to your experience, you know, with your physician, there's a couple aspects of it that are not terribly surprising to me. The first is recognizing that that physician is probably operating in the medical system as it currently stands, which, you know, is oriented in such a way that he probably or she probably has to see a whole lot of patients in a given day, many of whom have numerous complex medical conditions. They also have to interact with the insurance aspect and trying their best to stay on time and to complete their documentation, and a whole lot of demands and people and things tugging at their attention. And then, you know, you come in and you are presumably a pretty generally healthy guy. You might be the healthiest patient that they see all day, and your lab work might look pretty good, as I would expect it to for the most part. It's not going to be completely haywire. And so, you know, they see you strolling in compared with the last patient they saw who maybe is on 15 different medicines and needs oxygen at home for their chronic lung disease and is, you know, missed out on several of their, you know, cancer screenings and might, you know, drink a little bit too much alcohol and not use their CPAP for their sleep apnea at night. And then you stroll in and you look great, you feel great, most of your lab tests are okay. And I can see a scenario where they, you know, are quite reassured by what you got going on. They say, you really don't need to, you know, see me for much going on today and send you on your way before they get back to, you know, the next kind of more typical patient that they might see, which are the kind of people, again, that I often admit to the hospital, but interact with much less in my, like, coaching practice as it relates to athletes.
Yeah. Well, I guess I'm a low risk person to die walking back out to my car.
Yeah.
So, you know, less of a risk for their livelihood. But still, you know, people like me, you know, maybe starting 15 years ago, we've been not just trying to stay okay. Mm-hmm. We try to get better.
Yeah.
You know, we're sort of kind of fighting against gravity. You know, time is not a friend to our health, to our athletic performance. And so, you know, we compensate it. And maybe at first it was by not drinking as much and focusing on getting more rest and trying to eat a better diet. But then, you know, it also can get into, you know, more exotic things, you know, supplements and even off-label pharmaceuticals that, you know, maybe are intended for performance enhancement, but maybe they're just intended to, instead of like stay in the normal range on my blood markers, I want to be optimal. Mm-hmm. I don't want to be like all those unwell normal people.
Yeah, right.
I'm trying to be better than that. So, you know, where's optimal? You know, and then if you look hard enough, you can find where there's been studies and they're looking at all cause mortality versus some blood marker.
Sure.
And, oh, you know, it's not anywhere between 2 and 2,000. It's really 135. That's the number that, you know, according to this set of statistics, if I'm on that number, I have the best chance of living a long time. So I'm reducing my rate of aging, or, you know, whatever that all means in terms of, you know, just I'm being healthier mm-hmm. for that blood marker. And then what about this other blood marker? And then, of course, how to do that is really tough. And I guess that maybe that kind of gets back to why is there such a reluctance maybe from the medical industry to do it is, well, what are you going to do with this information? If it's not going to change anything, then I don't want to spend any money to do it. I mean, the people who pay the bills don't want to spend any money to do it. And okay, I understand how that works. But, you know, even if there is no, like, the shoes untied, tie the shoe, you know, put the hat back on the snowman thing, it's not as simple as that. If I can see that there's a rate of improvement and I'm unhappy that my my watts, you know, my FTP is down from where it was 3 years ago, I now have more motivation. So maybe it's an indirect mm-hmm. what I can do about it.
Yeah.
But what would you say?
Sure. Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about medical testing. And this is going to be kind of applicable to a lot of different types of tests. I know we're going to focus a lot on blood tests today. And so there's a lot of important concepts that I kind of think are worth laying out. The first is that tests can be used in two different ways. The first is in a diagnostic way. And what that means is a person has a given complaint, concern, symptom, issue going on. And in order for the physician to either make a more accurate diagnosis or in order for them to guide specific treatment of that, you know, concern, complaint, symptom, issue that they have going on, a test of some kind, a blood test, an imaging test, whatever the case is, allows them to refine that information. It gives them more accurate, precise information in order to, for example, if I have a person with chest pain and I'm trying to differentiate between, is this chest pain related to their heart or to some other structure, perhaps there's a test that can help me to prioritize between the two if I'm not able to determine it just from talking to the patient or examining them. So that's a diagnostic test.
So if I have a symptom, I can use a blood test or some test to clarify what that symptom might be from.
Exactly. That is the appropriate use of diagnostic testing. It is to kind of either narrow down between the diagnostic possibilities, or for example, sometimes once you have an established diagnosis, tests can be used on an ongoing basis to monitor, you know, the response to treatment. That could be, for example, monitoring somebody's blood sugar over time who has diabetes, or monitoring you know, somebody who has a cancer. There are certain kinds of tests that we call tumor markers, and we like to see those go down when somebody is responding to cancer treatment. And if they pop back up, then suddenly we're concerned about a, you know, a recurrence or a relapse of the cancer, something like that. So that is the use of of testing from a diagnostic standpoint. That is probably more of a separate topic than what we're going to talk about for a fair amount of today. The other potential use of testing is what we call in a screening capacity. And screening involves a situation where we are searching for an unidentified condition in a person who has no signs or symptoms of disease. They, you know, feel fine, they look fine, they don't have any specific symptom that would, you know, lead me to want to pursue diagnostic testing. They're just coming in saying, I'm doing okay. And performing a test of some kind on that person falls in the realm of screening, where we're searching for unidentified conditions in the person with no issues, right? Mm-hmm. And so these are separate kind of situations. So I'm going to tackle screening a bit first, because a lot of people are interested in getting that, you know, they come in and they say, I want the full panel. And I'm like, well, anything going on with you today? And they're like, no, I just want the full panel.
I just want it.
Yeah. And so that's the context that I'll start with.
Let me jump in and just say, this is what I can remember my doctor, you know, and the ranges are huge.
Yeah.
And that's because they're just looking for the diamond in the rough, the thing that they really don't expect to find, but once a year or every few years, let's just take a look and see what pops up. And when I'm at the very bottom of the range, they're like, get out of here. That's fine.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait a minute, I'm at the bottom of the range.
Yeah.
They're like, if you had a problem, it wouldn't be that good.
Sure. And gosh, the amount of the messiness of this entire world of screening and test interpretation is huge. And it's something that I talk about a fair amount, because it's very easy to order tests and to do tests. the ability to accurately interpret them in the context of the patient and what they have going on is exceptionally more difficult. And so I think, you know, nowadays, having in more information, having data, it's super sexy. Having, you know, lab report printouts that show you, you know, a normal range, an optimal range, you know, a red light, yellow light, green light kind of system, it makes it a very nice, neat, tidy sort of narrative to, you know, somebody who might get a test that is not in that normal range, and then they feel like they either do something or intervene in some way to try to get that number to green. And, you know, it's possible to do that for a whole lot of things, but that is not necessarily answering the question of, did any of this impact my life, my performance, how I feel, how long I live, anything like that. That's something that needs to be examined really on a case-by-case basis. And that doesn't mean person to person. That means like each individual test will vary in terms of how well it performs to diagnose a particular condition, to rule certain things in, to rule certain things out. They can vary day to day, hour to hour throughout the day sometimes. And then the way that they correlate with or potentially cause disease is super variable among all of them. And so, you know, it's there's no such thing as just do the full panel. Sometimes patients ask for that. There is no one full panel because, you know, the idea of performing a test is I need to have something in mind when I am doing this test that I'm looking for the presence of or the absence of, because it's all based on probabilities, right? So if I have a patient who has a very high probability of a condition and I do a test to look for it and I find it, I'm confident that I've got a true positive test, right? But if I have somebody who has a very low probability of something happening and I do a test and it's positive, there is actually a far higher chance that that represents a false positive test than it is a true positive. And this is counterintuitive to a lot of people, but tests are not perfect. They are so far from perfect. And I think because it is viewed as objective data, people put a lot more confidence in the accuracy and the meaning of tests than they actually should deserve. People would be shocked to learn about the false positive rates for a lot of tests or the false negative rates for a lot of tests that are done. And the idea that you could just broadly throw a bunch of tests at the wall, see what sticks, find some things that look out of the normal range and intervene upon them, you could very easily be doing all sorts of things based on a false positive result. You could very easily be missing things based on a false negative result. And so that's why, you know, I get consultations from patients a lot who are interested in performance and health and this kind of space. And they send me their labs and they say, what do you think? And I say, I need to talk to you. I can't just look at these numbers. I need to know more about you and the context and what led to these tests getting done. And are you feeling anything? Are you noticing it? Because all of that frames the way that I interpret these tests. So, you know, that's kind of the big picture. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of noise. There's a lot of biological variation. There's a lot of individual person-to-person variation. There's day-to-day, hour-to-hour variation. And there's the fact that the tests themselves are imperfect in terms of their accuracy and reliability. You know, you could do the same test 2 days in a row on yourself and you're going to get different results. They're not going to be identical. And so every test has a kind of an error bar around it. And so when you overlap that error bar on top of what the normal range of the test is, you could be seeing trends over time in your labs that are not real trends at all. It could just be noise of these numbers bouncing up and down within the normal range of biological variation, test variation, things like that. So that's why it's very difficult to interpret blood tests with no context about the person, what they have going on. And it's even harder when they're used in a screening capacity. Again, when somebody has no signs or symptoms or complaints to frame my interpretation of the test.
Well, okay, I'm going to throw out that it seems to me that given what you have said, that if you can afford it, you're better off getting more data points than you are having fewer data points, because having normal fluctuation in the results is going to be even harder to figure out what's going on if you're only got one data point every couple of years. I actually know a fellow who does like every week blood tests, which is a lot, but he's got a ton of data, and he talks about the amazing variability that he's had to work on trying to minimize, that is a result of like how the lab does things, how long the lab takes to do tests and things like that. I'm getting an appreciation for the challenge that the medical industry has. these false positives, making people feel crazy. Now they have imagined symptoms that they didn't have before because you told them, oh, this is low or that's high. I'm going to say I'm different. And so people who want data, and they are aware, now that you've shared this with them, that the results are, you know, there's some variability in the results. They want more data. What we could help people with is help them to understand how to have less variability in their results. I mean, what are the things that wrecks their test results? And ultimately, this is why I sought you out. It was because I did a blood test where I was dehydrated. I knew better than to do that, but I still did it kind of without thinking, and the results were crazy. And finally, I figured out, oh, wow, I hadn't had anything to drink for like 14 hours. You know, would that have made a difference when I was talking to the provider? And they're like, oh, yeah. I mean, that would totally change the numbers. And then I started thinking, well, you know what? Every time I get a blood test, I always drink water beforehand so that my blood volume is good and it's easy to find the vein. Well, am I changing my results because I drank some water? Well, what are the other things? Fasted, not fasted, what time of day? You know, did I exercise the day before? The supplements that I took 2 days before? I mean, there must be a million things.
Sure. Yeah.
Can you help us with that?
I will certainly get to that. One comment I wanted to make about what you mentioned before, this idea that you necessarily want more data. And I think that if there's something in particular that you are tracking and wanting to track closely, then that can be a reasonable approach. You know, I recognize that there are differences, as I mentioned, between like diagnostic testing and screening testing. There's also a difference between, you know, testing even within the screening category for like general population health versus what I'm going to call like medical hobbyists, which are people like your audience who really want to watch and follow all of this stuff in close detail. It almost is a hobby in some ways that you're interested in and does not seem to greatly detract from your quality of life, broadly speaking. I think it certainly can. You know, a lot of people can get very kind of neurotic and attached to certain numbers, almost independent of how they're actually doing in their day-to-day life. And so I would just caution people, you know, in that light, there are very basic, very fundamental things that are broadly advisable for people as it relates to health and performance. I spent some time writing an article for our site on this. I called it something to the effect of like 7 health priorities that are the basic things that you would probably identify as good advice, focusing on maintaining a healthy body composition, a health-promoting varied dietary pattern, meeting physical activity guidelines of strength training and aerobic conditioning, getting sufficient sleep, you know, things like that. And nobody needs biomedical testing to pursue and follow those types of things, right? There's no biomedical test that's going to, you know, alter my recommendation that people get sufficient high quality sleep or that they eat a varied high, you know, health promoting dietary pattern or that they maintain a healthy body composition. And so if those are things that are, well, first of all, not being met, for example, if somebody doesn't have a healthy, you know, dietary pattern, doesn't exercise, you know, isn't getting sufficient high quality sleep, those would be overwhelmingly higher priority items for me than just doing a lot of blood testing. Because the recommendation for those things so far outweighs, you know, any potential, you know, benefit of doing the tests. But to the extent that somebody is meeting all of those things and wants to get this testing done, perhaps because they want to keep track of certain things or they have things that they're wanting to monitor, or because they're interested in performance, then I would, the first thing I would want to do is just to think for yourself, what is this test telling me? And how am I acting upon this information? Because if it is not telling you anything useful, then you don't need to get that test done. Just because you can get it done, just because it's inexpensive, just because you're already at the lab, doesn't mean that you should do it. Because there may always come a time where you pop some kind of weird false positive result and it induces some panic, and then you have to get a bunch more follow-up testing to clarify it, which is oftentimes best avoided. And then similarly, if it's not something that you have anything that you can do about or that you're acting upon or something like that, similarly, I would just, you know, ask yourself whether this is worth getting done. And especially if it's worth monitoring, you know, A, at the frequency that you're monitoring it, or B, whether it's worth monitoring at all. I will admit, I've been an athlete myself for, you know, I suppose 20 years now in different sports. I view myself as somebody who's very interested in health and performance and longevity and things like that, and I do not routinely get blood tests done. I have no signs or symptoms or complaints outside the usual aches and pains of sometimes when I do a little bit too much too soon in a given task, or I don't feel great if I don't sleep very well, or if I'm a little hungover or something like that. But outside of those things, blood tests are not likely to tell me a ton that I don't, you know, already know to do for my health. Now, to your question that you did ask me there.
Well,
Sure.
You made a nice segue. But I want to push back a little bit on your segue before we get into the nitty-gritty, which really is one of the main things I wanted this talk to be about. So we definitely are coming back to this. Maybe you've spoken to a lot of people like me, you know, my age, and you can step into their shoes and you can feel it. But, you know, you get to, there's a point in your life and you're on the down slope. Now, maybe I'm at the middle of my lifespan.
I'd like to think so.
I mean, yeah. Okay. Yeah. Why not? That's what I'm aiming for. But man, I am not what I was. And I'm doing way better than anybody I know my age. So it's definitely coming and I'm fighting hard and I can't do everything perfectly. So what I'm dying to get information to help me do is prioritize. Where do I have the biggest gap, the lowest hanging fruit, and I'm going to focus on that rather than the thing that I enjoy the most, and I'm already doing great at that. You know, maybe my VO2 max is already like a 35-year-old. You know, why am I trying to go for that last half of a point on that, you know, maybe that's not even helping my health.
Yeah.
Just because I like it and I can, you know, get a tattoo on my forehead with that number. But maybe I got some other things where I'm really needing to focus, and this information would help me. But it's only going to help me. So let's going to circle back now to the main point here. And this is what you have educated me about already. That it's only going to help me if the data is useful. And if the data's, if the error bars are too big, then the data is useless. It's just going to send me off on wild goose chases. I'm not actually figuring out where I have low-hanging fruit. So there's, I guess, two things. One is you can tell us how we can lower the variability by just being sensible in how we do these tests. And then the other is then maybe you can come back and argue about how even if you did them perfectly, the error bars are still really too big, and you setting your ego, Joe, by what your biological age calculator says that, you know, you're down 15 years based on these blood markers that are affected by every odd 0.1. That's nuts. The tests are not that accurate, even if you did them perfectly. Okay. Okay, there we go.
Yeah, so in terms of the variation as it relates to our behavior, there are some broad kind of concepts here, but then there are several that are going to be more test specific in terms of the things that we do that impact this particular test, right? So in general, you know, a lot of times people are used to fasting for their blood tests, for example, and fasting will impact some things, but not others. For example, I would not expect fasting or being fasted or fed to impact whether your hemoglobin levels look okay, right? That's something that is not going to be relatively insensitive to that as a variable.
Okay.
Whereas if you have just eaten, for example, right before you got your blood test done, that can lead to testosterone measurements. If that's something you're checking, that can be suppressed in the aftermath of a meal. If you eat a meal, particularly if it's a fatty meal, your blood triglyceride levels can be actually elevated after something like that. So those are just a couple examples of how being fasted or fed can impact a few particular tests. But there's not a broad general concept of all tests are going to be skewed in this direction or that direction from being fasted or fed. It's kind of a test-to-test thing. Hydration, similarly, can impact some things. If you're severely dehydrated, it can actually lead to actual kind of what I would call like true lab abnormalities. For example, your kidney function might not look quite as good if you're severely dehydrated because kidneys require adequate hydration to kind of function normally. Your blood sodium levels can be elevated if somebody's very dehydrated. that's actually can be a real kind of abnormality that can emerge from hydration. Whereas in other situations, you can have something that is kind of falsely elevated or falsely suppressed by changes in hydration status. For example, if you're very dehydrated, yeah, your hemoglobin and your hematocrit, your blood measurements, particularly your hematocrit, can be abnormal, can look abnormally concentrated if you're very dehydrated. Whereas if you just chugged a whole bunch of water, there are other things that might be kind of diluted a bit downwards. Some things are truly diluted, like your blood sodium level. You can get hyponatremia, for example, from drinking a lot of fluid, and other things that can be more kind of falsely diluted, not to a problematic degree. And so, you know, I see this actually pretty often in I just saw this probably within the past 2 days in the hospital setting, where I had a patient who came in and their blood concentrations, like their white blood cell count, hemoglobin, hematocrit, platelet count, all looked abnormally high for who the patient was. In other words, I thought, yeah, they you know, don't have any significant, you know, blood, you know, cancers or background problems that would lead me to suspect that their blood levels will be too high. Everything looks pretty high. Their calcium's high, their albumin's high, and albumin being high is like a giveaway that this person's probably too concentrated in their blood, dehydrated. And I'm like, ah, just give them a little bit of fluid and then we'll recheck. And then sure enough, the next day everything was normalized because their blood levels were too concentrated. Kind of some touching on the fasted fed aspect, the hydration status. Exercise can similarly impact some blood tests, but not necessarily others. The main ways that exercise can impact blood tests is, I would say, that the most common one is by exercise-induced muscle damage. So, for example, when somebody lifts weights, it's obviously normal to induce some degree of muscle damage. That's part of what happens with strength training and kind of stimulates some of the adaptations in the aftermath of the training session. But anytime you have any kind of muscle cell that gets damaged, its contents get released into the bloodstream. And what kinds of things are contained within muscle cells? Well, there are certain enzymes, for example, AST, which is commonly a test that shows up as part of a liver panel most often, and then creatine kinase, or CK, is something that gets released from muscle cells. And so if somebody happens to get, you know, a liver panel done, for example, in the aftermath of a hard training session, their liver enzymes, their AST, their ALT, are going to likely be elevated to some degree. And it might make somebody suspicious that, oh, you might have something going on in your liver, might have some fatty liver disease, some hepatitis, something like that, when really it's just because those are packaged in a liver panel very often, even though those enzymes are not exclusively from the liver. They're also found in other tissues like muscle cells. So this is another common consultation that I'll deal with is somebody who's a power lifter who trains, they got some blood tests, their doctor freaked out that they have hepatitis. And I say, well, you probably just need to get these tests repeated. You can make sure you don't have hepatitis. That would be wise. I would check those things anyway. Now that you found that, you're kind of stuck ruling that out. Yeah. But you can take, you know, plan whenever if you're going to have the next weekend off or something, you're going to train on Friday, have the weekend off, go in and get your labs done, say Monday, Tuesday, after a bit of time off. And those should normalize if it is just related to exercise and not related to.
Miss a workout, no
exactly.
way.
Exactly. I fully understand and identify with that concern. If somebody told me I had to take several days off in order to get more accurate lab tests. And part of the problem is that these things have different kind of kinetics or half-life. The concept is like how long these take to clear out of your system to normalize. Each individual lab parameter has a different kind of trajectory of how long it takes. Some blood tests are, you know, like your lactate, for example. Especially you guys, if you're in great shape, you know, your lactate clearance, if you did a super hard interval set and we measured a lactate level, it would be very high after you know, in the immediate, as soon as you did your hard interval. But, you know, ideally, few minutes afterwards, you know, it's cleared pretty rapidly, right? Whereas some of these other measurements may take a few days. Some blood tests can take even longer than that to, you know, in terms of how long they take to change. So there's a few kind of examples of feeding, fasting, hydration status, exercise, how those can impact things. There are also other things, you know, lifestyle kind of habit-wise, even, for example, how well you slept or if you're on a normal sleeping schedule that can impact, for example, if you're getting any kind of hormones tested, because a fair amount of hormones function on a kind of a circadian rhythm. So for example, our testosterone levels an adult male who is on a normal sleeping schedule, their testosterone levels, as for example, another hormone that fits in this category would be cortisol, is expected to increase and peak in the early morning, say between like around 8 in the morning, more or less. And then it normally will decline throughout the day and dip to a low in the afternoon, evening hours before it repeats that cycle. if somebody has a horrific, you know, screwy night of sleep or something like that, that can impact that lab test.
Just one night of bad sleep.
Oh, yeah. And that can similarly impact, you know, blood sugar levels can be elevated after an abnormal night of sleep because that impairs our insulin sensitivity. So shift work, people who work night shifts, for example, that becomes a whole mess if I wanted to do any kind of like hormone testing on somebody who works night shifts, or definitely if they work like rotating shifts. Sometimes you have ER doctors who work a day shift, an afternoon shift, an evening shift, and then they repeat the cycle. Your body doesn't know which way is up in that context, and doing a hormone test in that context is really difficult. So I would say hormone testing is some of the most difficult for people to accurately interpret because there's so many things that can impact it. There's the circadian rhythm aspect, and there's just, you know, different people function with different kind of hormone levels. Even within the normal range, different people live at different levels. So that's just examples of where there's more noise in the system. But those are a few examples of how lifestyle habits like feeding, drinking, exercise, and sleep can potentially impact some of the variability that we see in these lab results. I would say that to the extent that you're able to, from, you know, draw to draw, keep things as consistent as possible, that would be the, you know, most obvious way to minimize variation insofar as your like lifestyle and habits and behaviors are concerned, trying to make it essentially the same kind of context that you're getting it measured in. That would be the best way to try to minimize the variation from your habit standpoint. Does that adequately answer?
That was great. One thing you didn't touch on, I wanted to ask you about, is supplements or even medications. I think it's probably obvious to not take stuff, you know, the morning of. Although I think I've read in the instructions sometimes is like, keep taking your normal meds.
Yeah.
And I'm always like, what? Wow, isn't that going to affect anything? But I also have read that things like biotin can have many days of effect.
Yeah. So this is another one that's kind of a little challenging to speak on broadly because it's more of a case by case basis as far as what medicine and what test in terms of the impact. I would agree in general with the concept of continuing to do your routine, including whatever medications and supplements you're taking as it relates to testing. There are some exceptions, though. So, for example, to your point on biotin, it's relatively infrequent that I think medically somebody needs to supplement biotin. I know people do it anyway for a host of reasons. But that's something that's well known to throw thyroid function tests off radically sometimes. It can make people look like they have significant hyperthyroidism even when they don't. And so that's a known source of error, particularly as it relates to thyroid testing. Creatine supplementation, super common, well-researched, well-supported, you know, sports and performance, you know, ergogenic type supplement. But creatine in some folks seems to have an impact on blood creatinine levels. And that's because creatine gets metabolized into creatinine. And we use creatinine as a marker of how well your kidneys are filtering. And so, you know, it can falsely elevate your creatinine measurements, making it look like you're in kidney failure potentially, when really you're not in kidney failure and the creatine isn't causing your kidney failure because it doesn't do that. Rather, it's just a false elevation because of the metabolism of creatine. So that's something that I've had patients who, you know, I find out they're on that and it's like, okay, well, we should probably take or skip that for a few days before we get this rechecked, or I'll also recheck another marker of kidney function to see, you know, does it correlate, or are they actually having kidney problems or not? So I think that most of the time, you know, especially if the patient's taking a medicine and I want to like monitor, is that medicine having the impact that I want, then continuing to take it, of course, would make sense. So patient, for example, with diabetes, who's on diabetes medicines, I don't want them to stop taking their diabetes medicine when I go to check how their blood sugar is doing, because then I'm not going to get the information that I want out of it. So most of the time, I would have patients continue taking what they're taking. As it relates to supplements, you know, those I care less about if somebody doesn't take it on the day of testing. And there are some, like the ones that we mentioned, among, I'm sure there would be others, that I would actually advise not get taken on the day of a test to avoid skewing some of those results.
Okay. And what about like foods that maybe I ate the day before, or alcohol, or things like that?
Sure. So foods, there aren't specific foods that I would expect to have kind of reliable impacts on the testing. Now, of course, the things that you eat can impact things like your blood sugar and your blood cholesterol levels and things like that. Although much more of that operates on a longer term basis than like I ate, you know, a cookie yesterday, so my blood sugar the next day is high. That's not really how that would work, because that's a much kind of more dynamic, shorter term thing. So I don't think it's worth people sweating too much, you know, the specific things that they eat, say the day before they get a test done. I would go about your routine. As it relates to alcohol, you know, I think that, of course, you know, alcohol in excess is never a good idea. And to the extent that you're drinking so much alcohol that I can tell from a blood test, I'm very concerned about you. Because if I can see evidence of liver injury, for example, then that's, we're in like binge drinking territory. So I should not see evidence that you're drinking on your blood test.
Although it might be low blood sugar.
Potentially, although patients without diabetes, for them to get frankly low blood sugars, say down into like the range of 50 or less is very uncommon. We have very robust mechanisms to avoid that sort of phenomenon. But, you know, if I did see signs, I can, you know, I see a lot of alcohol-related issues in my hospital work, and sometimes I can just pull up a patient's labs, and from the labs alone, I can tell that they have, you know, an alcohol use disorder, they have cirrhosis from alcohol use, something like that. So I shouldn't tell that, ideally. So that's as it relates to food and drink. Unless there were any other kind of topics you wanted to discuss as it relates to behaviors, I'm also happy to touch on the other aspect of the test variation.
I would like to talk about that. But before we leave this topic, I guess here's how I'd like to put a bow on it. And that is that, you know, for people like me who do this fairly regularly, and of course, my insurance company is not going to have any part of that.
Right.
For $100 now, you can get, you know, a whole suite of things. And so there's, you know, there's just no, the natural impediment to it is gone.
Yeah.
And some of these tests are just, you do it in your house. It's just a little drop on a piece of paper and you can get all kinds of things. So how we wrap this part of the conversation up is, so what should people do? I'm not going to get a blood test every single week. I'm going to do it, you know, maybe every 3 or every 4 months. And so I'm going to do all of them all at once, whatever it is that I do. And I will ask you later, if I'm just doing it myself, what should I stay away from? Because I, you know, I have no business trying to interpret stuff like that. But so what should I do? Should I try to get my blood test done first thing in the morning so that it's, you know, I fasted already, I don't have to suffer. You know, how do I make sure I'm not dehydrated or overhydrated? You know, stuff like that. What would be like the ideal way to make it as unvariable as I could on my own?
Yeah. If you're choosing to pursue a testing with in general, and in particular with this degree of frequency, I think that maintaining as consistent of habits as you can from time to time is really, it sounds almost too simple to be sufficient advice, but really that would be the way that I would approach something like this.
Okay.
There are most blood tests you don't actually need to fast for. But if that becomes part of your routine, you say you're checking one thing that does benefit from fasting and the rest don't, just do it all while you're fat. That's totally fine. There's not tests that are going to be impacted adversely by fasting, you know, in general, outside of those few examples. And so if you wanted to do that on a consistent basis, that's fine. Doing it in the morning after a normal night of sleep would be, you know, preferable. And then just drinking to your, you know, usual thirst response, I would say is fine. Even on a, even for tests when you are supposed to be fasted, that is much more often, actually in every scenario, that does not include liquid fasting in terms of like clear liquids like water, tea, coffee, something like that.
So caffeine is fine?
Totally fine. Right. Oh, so when I have somebody
who... You've changed my life.
Yeah. When I have somebody who I do want to get fasting tests done, for example, which really are limited, again, in which tests those are, to just a couple things, I do not tell them to restrict from drinking any water at all, or to avoid drinking their morning tea or coffee or something like that. That is completely fine. Now, I would prefer that they not, you know, add a whole bunch of cream and sugar to things, because then suddenly you're consuming calories, and that can impact the results of some of the tests, or the sugar can impact, you know, blood sugar measurements and things like that. But liquids, just again, to your thirst and contentment, you don't have to overdo it, and you don't have to, you know, leave yourself super parched by the time, so that you leave your blood draw and you're just like, you know, the blood slowly trickled out of your vein and then you have to go out and chug a gallon of water just to feel normal again. I wouldn't want that scenario either. So I would say consistent, you know, diet the day beforehand. If you're going to fast, that's totally fine. It does not have to be like a 14-hour fast or a 12-hour fast. Like usually like 8 is more is plenty for most of these tests.
So overnight's enough.
Yeah, totally fine. And then just, you know, clear liquids, which includes water, tea, coffee, without added stuff to it, is totally fine. And then doing that on a relatively, you know, consistent time frame would make sense to me as a way to minimize variation from that aspect.
And maybe don't sweat your medications that you would normally take anyway.
Yeah.
And I guess if you, I mean, I probably would skip my supplements because I take them with food.
Yeah. I think that skipping supplements is totally fine, especially if it's a supplement that's known to impact some of the tests that you're getting done. Yeah.
Okay. Fantastic. That was great. Thank you. So let's move into the, I did everything right.
Yeah.
I still have variability. Yeah. How, you know, what can I rely on?
Sure.
If at all.
Yeah. I'm going to provide you with a resource for yourself and for your audience that I think will be very, very enlightening. So I'll send you, I think there's a, I don't know if there's a chat function here, but if you Google this title, it's from the British Medical Journal. The title is Your Results May Vary, the Imprecision of Medical Measurements. It's from BMJ in 2020. And again, I'm happy to share the link with you. But basically, this tool is really nice, and it is designed such that you can pick a particular test. It doesn't necessarily have every test under the sun, but it has quite a lot of tests that you might be interested in getting done as part of your routine. And you can select the test, and it shows you, you know, for that particular test, what is the usual analytical variation that happens as a result of just test error within that lab as it's performing it. And then it also includes an example of what biological variation there is within people over time as a result of all sorts of variables. And then it compares that variation and the normal range against two hypothetical values that you might put in or values that you actually have measured in yourself. So you can say, last time I got it done, it was this. This time I got it done, it was this. I'll put the measurements in, and it'll show you, are these values different enough that I can be confident that this represents a real change? Or is it all fall within the mess of lab testing, analytical variation, biological variation? And I think you're going to be quite surprised at how often differences that you have observed from test to test fall within that range of error for yourself, such that you cannot confidently conclude that there's been any significant change. And this is just noise.
Okay, so this is like statistical error measurement, but for a person, and it's going to be based on, I guess they've done studies of this. I mean, maybe tested the same person again and again and again and again, and seeing how it moves. And
Exactly. Okay. So it's a very useful tool to illustrate this. And I think, again, people will be surprised. And what concerns me sometimes is, you know, I fully recognize that there's this kind of community of, we'll call them like health hobbyists.
Enthusiasts.
Enthusiasts, optimizers, whatever we're going to call
them. There we go.
Who really sweat things like the normal range versus the optimal range, or who will notice a subtle change in one of the parameters. Say that their testosterone level went from, you know, 625 to, you know, 585, and they are concerned about that, and they start looking up, what can I do to fix this, to boost it? What supplements can I take? And then all I do is I just, you know, look at the actual error bars around this test, and I'm like, I have no confidence that this is actually any different. And you've been freaking out about this, you know, to say, and it may not actually merit that. And so that's kind of, you know, I see in my day-to-day practice, again, I order, perform, interpret tests all the time. I am like fully on board with the utility of biomedical testing when it is deployed appropriately and interpreted by someone who knows how to interpret the data. But I also have seen the downsides of this. You know, I've seen folks who get some of these tests done, and because, for example, recently consulted with a guy whose blood testosterone level that he got, he wasn't getting the results he wanted in the gym, otherwise felt fine. Thought that justified, you know, checking his testosterone level, which by, you know, standard medical practice, we would actually not view that as an indication to evaluate for hypogonadism. Right. But did it anyway. He was on like a little bit lower end of the range than he would have liked to be. And then said, well, that's it. Case closed. I'm going to go on testosterone replacement. Started taking the testosterone replacement. Felt markedly worse. He said, I had such severe anxiety.
Oh, really?
He started having mood, you know, disturbances, impaired his sleep, and he was like, and I actually didn't get any stronger. And so all of this was a wild goose chase. And I was like, yeah, man, you know, this stuff is, it's kind of complicated. I wish it was as nice and neat as you check the test, and if it's not where you want it to be, you do something to move it to where you want it to be, and that fixes everything. But these are tricky. So That tool is what I would advise to you and your audience, just as an example to illustrate the intrinsic variation that there is to these tests over time, so that you can be more confident in your interpretation of, like, is this actually changing or not? And then trying to use that information more effectively. Because if it's changing, then the next question is, now what? Do I do something about this? Does this merit a change in my strategy, my training, my supplementation, or is this just noise? Is this expected, you know, change with time? And in which case, do I actually need to be monitoring this and worrying about it? Because there's downsides to that too sometimes.
And I'll add on to what you said. My conclusion is that you should not have a high degree of confidence that you need to do something major based on just that.
I like that. I like that advice. You know, I think tempering people's overconfidence is a great idea. Something that I suggest a lot of the time.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. This has been really good. I was afraid it would be, which is why I wanted to talk. But wow, part of the problem is we're just human beings. Yeah. We can't really help it. But, you know, in so many walks of life, you just find that people, you know, they drop their key over by the door, but they're looking for it under the street lamp because that's where the light is. You mm-hmm. know, the light's good there. And so, you know, I can see. And so, I got these blood tests and I got these numbers and they come to, they're very, you know, 0.002. You know, it seems pretty specific.
It feels accurate. It feels reliable. It feels objective. And I hate to be the person who brings some bad news that they are less of that than we would like. And, you know, there's on a daily basis, I get all sorts of tests. Again, I have several patients admitted to the hospital that I'm, you know, managing as we speak, and I do blood tests on them most days because they're acutely ill and there are all sorts of abnormalities on them. But that does not mean that I go out of my way to fix all of those abnormalities, because I know that some of them are noise. Some of them are irrelevant. Some of them are expected for their condition that might just take some time to resolve on its own. And then some of them I actually do need to do something about and intervene upon. And it takes training to be able to recognize which is which in those types of situations. So
Yeah. I'm not going to pick up that expertise by reading an article in GQ, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's tough.
Right. All right. We're running short of time, so I'm just going to pick. When we're doing blood tests, it really is just, it's just the blood. The blood is kind of an area of flux where, you know, I've got food coming in, often it's going like through my liver, and anyway, it's getting into the blood, and then the blood is going into organs and, you know, wherever blood goes, carrying nutrients, and then stuff comes out of the organs and goes into the blood, and the body is moving it around, and maybe some of it goes to the kidney and the kidney get rid of it. And anyway, but so what's in the blood is this, you know, it's this transient thing. It's not like if it was in my blood, that's the way it is everywhere in my body.
Correct.
My body is not a water balloon.
Correct.
Full of my blood.
Yeah.
I've got, you know, fat, which is storing things like, you know, fat soluble vitamins. Iron might be deposited in my liver and might be in my brain. And, you know, and checking my blood is not really giving me all the information that's available. So maybe this is maybe a part of this answer of why is it so variable? It's not just that the technology is imperfect. It's that, you know, we're measuring something that's fluctuating all the time.
Totally. It is just one compartment. And so even the blood itself is not just one compartment, right? So the blood is made up of your plasma, right? And that's what a lot of tests are run on. But there are also red blood cells, right? And other types of cells that are within your bloodstream. And so, for example, I know that when I do a basic blood chemistry test on somebody, I'm just looking at the plasma compartment. So I see a sodium level of 140 on their plasma, you know, sodium measurement. I see a potassium measurement of 4. What is going on inside their blood cells is completely different. The normal sodium level inside a blood cell is the opposite. It's like 4, and the normal potassium level is like 140. So it's completely backwards of the normal concentrations in the plasma. And so that's just an example of from the plasma to within the blood cell. That's different than the concentrations of things in our tissues. And so, for example, that's what when we see people who use continuous glucose monitors and they have a little catheter that's in the interstitial space of their tissues – That's different. That's slightly different than a capillary glucose measurement or a plasma glucose measurement from the bloodstream. There's some differences between them because you're measuring different compartments. As you mentioned, some substances, some things preferentially distribute into certain tissues that a blood test does not give us an accurate sense of, right? And then all of this is within the scope of biological variation that emerges from our day-to-day habits, our lifestyle habits, all the things I mentioned earlier. But the fact is that our bodies and our physiology are so phenomenally good at maintaining homeostasis, right? Our kidneys can alter the composition of our urine on a minute-to-minute basis in order to maintain perfect blood levels of these electrolytes, right? Mm-hmm. And we should be very grateful to our kidneys for being able to do that, because if we had to micromanage our own blood electrolyte levels, it'd be so much more than a full-time job. We wouldn't be able to do anything else, right? We wouldn't be able to function on remembering to breathe or beat our heart if we had to worry about maintaining, you know, proper sodium and calcium measurements, because our kidneys do such a phenomenal job of that for us. Mm-hmm. So there are all these different compartments. There's all this variation from our lifestyle. There's variation as our bodies battle what, you know, our day-to-day to maintain homeostasis. And then the tricky thing is there are also things that can have kind of counterintuitive effects on our blood levels. So I'll give you a couple examples of things that can also throw some test interpretation off. So there's a phenomenon whereby our body has a response to any kind of insult, inflammation, infection, any kind of stressor. It's called the acute phase response. Some things in our blood increase in the setting of an acute phase response. We call these acute phase reactants. These are substances that react by going up in the setting of this acute phase, this, you know, response to inflammation or stress. Okay. There are also other substances that we call negative acute phase reactants. Those are things that go down in the setting of this kind of stressor. So an example, ferritin is an acute phase reactant. If you have any kind of acute physiologic stress, illness, infection, inflammation, right? Ferritin can go up. With chronic inflammation, ferritin can go down. Vitamin D is a negative acute phase reactant, meaning that when people get sick or inflamed or have a physiologic stressor, vitamin D levels go down. Now, let me talk through the implications of this. Let's imagine it's early to mid 2020. Pandemic is striking, COVID's happening, people are getting sick left and right, and doctors and medical researchers are desperate to try to find stuff that we can do to help people. So we do a cross-sectional study. We take a group of people who are healthy, and we take a group of people who are sick with COVID, and we measure all of their blood vitamin D levels. Okay. What result do we see? Well, people who were sick with COVID, they had an acute phase response. Some things went up. Things like ferritin went up. Interleukin 6 goes up, C-reactive protein goes up. Those are all positive acute phase reactants. And then other things go down in that illness setting. Vitamin D goes down, testosterone goes down, thyroid stimulating hormone might go down. Those are normal expected responses to that kind of illness. What's the result of that kind of study? All these patients with COVID had low vitamin D levels, whereas none of the patients who were healthy had low vitamin D levels. Therefore, people should supplement vitamin D to not get COVID. That line of reasoning does not work, as evidenced by the fact that we did studies on giving people vitamin D to reduce the risk of bad outcomes from COVID, and it doesn't work. Similar to how it doesn't work to improve a lot of different health outcomes. The research on vitamin D is overwhelmingly underwhelming would be how I would summarize it, because of that logical error in the interpretation. It was low as a result of the illness, not as a cause of it, and that's why when we supplement it, it doesn't prevent the illness, yet that difference between people who are sick and not sick persists. And we see this for all sorts of things. I could have done the same COVID test study on blood testosterone levels, and it's going to show that people who are in the ICU with COVID have low testosterone levels, and people who are walking around in the community and healthy don't. Therefore, I should put everybody on testosterone to prevent COVID. That will not work. So that's an example of another variable, this acute phase response, either positive or negative, that can throw these tests off in different directions. And if we don't know that, we don't recognize it, then it can lead us to erroneous conclusions, like everybody should be supplementing with vitamin D, for example. Because I could do the same thing for all of these different substances. Again, testosterone gets low when you're sick. Should everybody be on testosterone? Albumin goes down when you get sick. this is, you know, albumin does not save anybody's life, really, for the most part. If even if, when I give it intravenously to most patients, it doesn't really seem to have benefit when it's been researched. Similarly, other things go up. Does that mean that I should bleed you out to bring your ferritin down when you have inflammation? No, that was tried with George Washington. It didn't pan out too well for him, right? So this concept of an acute phase response, I'm spending a little time on it just because it's an example of how lack of understanding of this can lead to erroneous interpretation and conclusions about what we should do.
Right. So this, you know, association is not causation thing. It's really worse than that. I mean, you're not even sure if it's a cause or if it's an effect.
Correct. Exactly right. And the thing that might be useful for your audience to know as well is pretty much every nutritional blood test is bad for this. Any nutritional blood test pretty much tend to be mostly negative acute phase reactants. So if you measure your blood zinc level, selenium level, copper level, all of those kind of things, I put very little stock in most of those blood tests in most situations, particularly if somebody is ill or sick or inflamed or something like that. That's why I almost never perform them on patients who I see in the hospital, because I'm predicting. I'm like, it's going to be low, not necessarily because they're deficient, but because it's a negative acute phase type.
Reactive
type of thing. Exactly. Yes, exactly.
Wow, Dr. Baraki, this has been so good. Thank you very much. Before we leave, tell our audience how they can find you, this article that you wrote. I found that tool, the BMJ thing that you were speaking of, and I'll put that in the show notes.
Perfect.
And I'll put anything that you say people can use to find you online as well.
Sure. Appreciate it. Yeah. Had a fun time talking about this stuff. So, I'm available through Barbell Medicine. People can go to barbellmedicine.com. We have a website, a podcast, a YouTube channel, where content goes up. The health priorities article, I think if you just search probably health priorities, Barbell Medicine, I'm there. We do a lot of put out a lot of educational health information. We do stuff focused on strength training. We have some endurance content, not a ton there. And then we also have a very active rehabilitation, pain and injury rehabilitation kind of consultation service for people. So we work with a lot of athletes who have aches and pains and injuries and help them get back to their normal activity. And that spans people from all walks of life who are strength training, endurance, or lay people alike. So that's kind of a lot of the stuff that I do there. So can find me there, can contact me through Barbell Medicine for, consultations or anything like that. That's all available there. So.
Awesome. I've actually listened to that podcast many times over the last few years. Maybe I've even heard you there, but I didn't put two and two together. I heard you on another podcast where I thought you were amazing, and so that's why I reached out to you. But that's a great website. The Barbell Medicine guys are top notch. So
thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that they were attracted to you. So great. Well, thanks for that, Dr. Baraki. Thanks again. Have a great night.
Yep. Thanks.
Alrighty. Bye bye. Thank you so much for joining my conversation today with Dr. Baraki. You can find more information about Dr. Baraki in the show notes.